A lot of creators get stuck in that sort of middle ground. Like they'll have a couple viral hits and they'll accrue a bit of a top line audience, but they're not getting the reach on that audience. And it's because they're creating, I call it like selfish content, right? Like I'm going to make what I want to make. And if it doesn't do well, I'm going to blame the algorithm or whatever. And that's the same in everything. It's like, what does the customer actually want? I think that's really what the sauce of what made Epic work is like, I'm not an expert. I don't proclaim to be. I just love doing it. And I'll teach you how along with me. And then you translate that to all these different media formats. And when I, at least in the media side, when I look out at all these brands, I still go, they don't get it. Like they don't understand the way that people want to consume.
Welcome to season 4 of Perpetual, where you'll get the hottest takes and insights on what's happening in the constantly shifting world of media and marketing. I'm Adam Ryan. Let's go.
Kevin, I've been looking forward to this one for a while. You are an absolute inspiration for all of the creator content to commerce themes. I can't make a deck without using you as a prime example. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Hey man, thank you. Thank you. I've weirdly looked to you guys a lot for the way you've approached it in the business space. And so I use you guys as a reference for our team on how to build out creators and stuff like that. So it's cool to be on.
I appreciate that. You know, just for everybody, I think what makes Epic Gardening so unique is that it's niche. It's consumer niche, which is like, you know, when we do healthcare system executives, that's niche, but in a different way. But that's a kind of a similarity. The advantage of that is all the things we'll talk about on this call. The disadvantage is some people may not know the brand if they're not into gardening. So would love to, if you're all right with it, share a little bit about the vision today and also how that's evolved from when you got started a few years ago.
Yeah, no, happy to. So, I mean, today, the current state of the business is we're a team of about, depends on the season. So we do a lot of our own fulfillment in our warehouse. So anywhere from like 50 to 80, depending on if it's spring or not. And revenue-wise, we did about 30 million last year. We have made a couple acquisitions, but like primarily where Epic came from was content. So it started with a blog. It started with a very, very small hydroponic gardening blog that's now become, I believe, we're the second or third, depending on the month, trafficked gardening blog on the internet. And hopefully we'll overtake that number one spot pretty soon. But there's some big giants up there that it's hard to go against Dot Dash Meredith sometimes. But regardless, expanded from that into video content. We now have 5 YouTube channels. Our main channel is the biggest one in the space in gardening. And then we're on all the social channels and we have podcasts and physical books and stuff too. So that's like from about 2016, when I really went full-time on Epic, to 2019, content was the business model. And then in 2019, started offering products, which doubled revenue that year. And so I was like, okay, well, clearly there's a, I know we're going to talk about content to commerce, but that was when I discovered that idea in my space. And in 2021, ended up raising some money at the very, very tail end of that year, but had done about 7.3 million in revenue across ads, brands, affiliate, and product being the predominant form of that revenue on like a team of 4 people. And so I was like, okay, there's something here that is bigger than I expected. And then, you know, now we've made some acquisitions. We're a little bit bigger than that. But yeah, it's been an interesting ride for sure.
I mean, that's a long time, first of all, 8 years at it. And pre-COVID, which I think also all great businesses catch a little bit of a tailwind at some point.
Yep.
You've talked about that a little bit of overnight. You're adding like 15,000 YouTube subscribers a day or something like that. But those 4 years leading up to that, you know, tiny, small team, 4 people, growth, good revenue numbers, but like, what was the moment there where you're like, we should move into product? What was the signal or intention that you kind of made that choice?
Early days was blog revenue, which is going to be your ad revenue, just display ad revenue, which you're trying to boost your RPM, right? Or affiliate revenue, which was predominantly on Amazon. And I think at the time, Amazon was paying 8% for a sale in the garden category, which was pretty high. Like if you were in tech, 2 or 3% was normal. In health, you know, we're one of the higher commission tiers. And so as that revenue started to scale up, I think without products in 2019, I would have done like $250,000 of revenue, which for me and one writer, it's like, I'm living a great life. I get to garden in my backyard. I have no problems here and very grateful to even have ever reached that level. But when you look at the dependencies of those revenue streams, I was like, okay, well, traffic is my lever point on my display ad revenue. And to some degree, also on my Amazon commissions or my brand deals or something. But also, you know, if that 8% changes, let's say that 8% goes to 4% on Amazon, just because Jeff Bezos wants it to, well, my revenue is cut by 50% on that stream. And so I had always been searching for product ideas and just was trying to kind of invent stuff, really like go full ground up. And then in 2019, I realized I was like, dude, brands are sending me stuff all the time. I like some of it. I don't like a lot of it. The stuff I love, I end up putting in the videos just because, and that's what they're hoping for. And there's a product that people just really responded to. So I just bugged the supplier for like three, four months, like emailing them every week. And finally they were like, yeah, sure, you can distribute it in America. And so the whole logic there is I was trying to become a less fragile business. I was like, well, I just don't want any of these streams to get cut off and then I'm just completely screwed. And so I'll take my destiny in my own hands and start offering product. And that went really well even in that year. And then of course, to have that infrastructure set up before 2020, like you said, I mean, that was in a way a stroke of luck, but you know, also preparation.
4 years of work, I don't think it's that luck. You just have those moments if you stick around long enough.
Yep.
The aspect of that story I think is so unique is we've had creators on the podcast, Aki McCormick, other people like that, you know, I'd say started this out of a hobby, right? And then like, whoa, all of a sudden it's a business and it's kind of by surprise. The other balance of that is as you switch to this is a business, how do we make it less fragile? How do I diversify revenue? What tends to happen is like this authenticity goes away. This like the juice, the secret sauce all of a sudden gets diluted. You raise a little capital, you got goals, you got all this stuff, and like content's not the same. You still make content in your backyard today. It like still feels the same way. Like how have you held yourself and the team as it's grown and scaled? How have you held yourself accountable to like maintain that authenticity?
It's legitimately probably the hardest thing to do, I'd say, because when you are trying to grow and obviously, you know, on a team of four, $7.3 million in revenue, like you're paying for your team. There's no problems doing that. And as you scale up and, you know, we acquired the seed company, Botanical Interest, which is an amazing brand. One of the first seed packs I ever grew way back in the day as well. So kind of a cool full circle moment, but you're right. Like there's more pressure. And so then the logic of creation starts to come from the reverse origin point. Instead of like, I think my viewers would really enjoy this, thus I'm going to make the content, even if I can't sell off the back of it. Sometimes you might not make that choice this time. And you'll say, well, what is the content that I can make that I can actually, you know, drop a seed mention in or a new product launch in? And so it's finding the balance of like, when I talk to creators, a lot of the times it's like on YouTube specifically, it's like one for you, one for the audience, one for the algorithm. And so you still have to keep that intact because the sauce is what made it work. And so you can't ruin the sauce pot. I don't know. It's a weird analogy, but you can't just start spamming commercial content 24/7 because that's completely counter to why it worked in the first place. But it's a hard balance because you're right. You have all these goals and you know, you're trying to hit your numbers and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and I feel like, and this is my own bias coming in, but like in consumer, that's even harder, right? In B2B, you can say, hey, I love Salesforce, but hey, you're in a different vertical. You're here. So you should use this other CRM. And like everyone can kind of like write that off as like, you're not choosing favorites. It's like, there's all these things, you know, I'm a little, like I said, this is my bias and ignorance a little bit, but like in consumer, that differentiation of products sometimes is like significantly less. It's brand and quality, of course, but I'm curious of as you started to, you know, let's take your favorite product that you were probably pushing organically. They reach out to you. They say, let's send you free stuff. Cause like, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, you're like, hey, you want to sponsor this? And they're like, can we just keep doing it for free? And that feels like how consumer marketers have been trained. How have you kind of overcome that? Like, we're not an influencer business that I'll get free shit, but I'm a business. I need money.
It's actually weird because we're still combating that to this day because the nature of a content first business like ours, which literally in its chronology was content first, but also from a sales perspective leads with the content. The nature is that it's not as visible that you're a product brand all the time. And so, especially when you have a lead face, which is still primarily myself, although we can talk about how we're working on that as well, they see Epic as Kevin Espiritu and vice versa. And so they want me to do a thing for them. And what we're trying to do with our teams, because frankly, brand revenue has never been a huge part of our business model in the first place. I typically refuse most brand deals regardless. But what we're trying to do now is say like, look, when you do a deal with Epic, let's say I don't know, good example, maybe Yard Zen is a company that I think is really interesting. If they wanted to do a deal with us, it's like, you're not getting Kevin, you're getting the Epic brand. And so we'll send a mailer out with you. We'll have your CEO on the podcast. We'll do this, we'll do that. So it's, we're trying to pitch it up more that way. And then to the point of like not being seen as influencers, it's an interesting navigation because what we've done, like one example, there's a vertical garden that we really like. I've historically grown in it for like 5 years now. And of course, as you're starting to develop your own products as a company, you could start butting heads with people who used to be your like business friends, so to speak, right? Like I used to just recommend that product. And now maybe I want to make my own vertical garden, but maybe I still love this product. And maybe there's something we can do together that's different because we can't spend our content real estate on just offering, you know, getting a 5% cut on a vertical planter anymore. But what we ended up doing in this particular case, the company's called Greenstock Garden. They're amazing. We went to them and we said, hey, look, we have our own warehouse. We love the product. We want to do like something custom for our fans. And so what we did is we just did a custom colorway with them and that was it. And so you can get Greenstock anywhere, but you can get Greenstock with the Epic color with us. Cool. And so that was a way that we lifted the relationship. Then there's other examples where I became the primary seller of this seed tray that my friend invented. And so I looked at it and I was like, dude, this seed tray is amazing. And I just quickly became like 95% of the revenue of the entire line of trays. And so I was like, hey, look, I'd love to work with you in more depth and develop this line of products out because I think they're amazing. And obviously our audience does too. But I can't like buy the business based on revenue because I'm making the revenue. And so what we did a deal, a creative deal where he came on as a product developer and we acquired like the mold assets to create the trays. And so there's ways to like kind of escalate and shift these relationships when you go from being like seen as a creator to like a creator that has a product business behind it.
I have always kind of openly said, like, I'm not smart enough to run a consumer media company. It's just, like, so many challenges. But one of those challenges is that it requires strategic partnerships at a very, very deep level. And I was only in consumer for a little bit with Under Armour My Fitness Pal, and I was working on this huge deal with a mattress company that today is like really well known and startup in the space. But Tom Brady had a different deal with mattress company. And UA was like, we need to go in that direction. And I remember being like, I get it. It's like the best thing. But I just worked like 3 months on this right deal and now it's going to fall apart. And in consumer, that's how that has to be done though, right? Like in the end, you do less vendors, deeper relationships, more strategic. And you all really have perfected that where I think a lot of even influencers, I just saw someone I really admire in the space. Like, I'm like, I know 4 months ago, you just pushed a competitor of this product. Like I know. I'm like, this is like how you kind of quickly go down this like negative spiral.
Yeah, dude, honestly, it's actually really frustrating because as we've become more successful, one of the downsides of being content first on promoting products in that way, primarily as an acquisition channel for sales, is that you're very much publicizing what you're up to. And, you know, speedy copycats can really start to chunk away at you. And we've had that happen. And at the same time, you start to realize who's an influencer, if you want to call them that, and who's like a creator slash business person, because I have people that I've known and personally helped over many years with their content or thinking about business or whatever, you know, and I'll watch them just chase the next deal. And I'll go, you don't actually care at all what you're recommending. And that's why you're going to fail. Like your lifespan on your business, if you want to even call it a business, which I'd be skeptical about, is like maybe a few years and you'll never pull a meaningful amount of that. It's like, might as well be an accountant or something. Like you're just going to run out the road because there's no like loyalty in the influencer space, I feel like, a lot of the time.
One of the rules that we try to follow, and we'll get into the creators here in a second, is that, you know, a deep belief of mine and always has been at The Hustle, I created like our first week. I said, hey, we have a block list of advertisers that like, they just don't fit our vibe and brand, right? Yeah. Like it's not a huge exhaustive list, but it's enough where like we draw the line in the sand. And we added to that list, like as, you know, for certain reasons. And with all the creators we work with, we still have that block list. But the reason for it is like, not a morality issue. Advertising's content, partnerships are content. Mm-hmm. Why do we put so much blood, sweat, soul, love into making this content great? And then you're just like going to sell it out for shit. Like, you know, and I think seeing it that way, and I think so many B2B creators like they don't like recognize it. And you all have done that in such a great way. Understanding the transition a little bit from, you're obviously still the face. You have a huge social presence. You're also just a terrific content creator, very natural.
Thanks, man.
But you know, we've had, last week we did the Fantasy Life podcast with Matthew Berry, and you know, Matthew Berry's football, he's a great creator, and he's trying to now build these like house of brands of other people that have that. Everyone's kind of approaching it differently. We're approaching it. If there's not a playbook that's been like proven over a decade yet. So how have you guys started to think about creating more brands through different creators?
Man, if there's a playbook, I haven't seen it, because it's actually crazy. And I tell the team, what we're trying to do in our space is unique. I have yet to see someone actually do this successfully. So we're either going to like destroy it and be ballers, or it might just not work. But I think the former is going to happen. But I mean, I can talk about the ways we've tried. I mean, the shining example, if you could do it this way every time, you would be you home grow talent in-house that probably didn't even start out that way. And so my shining example is this guy Jacques on our team, who's a friend of mine. He actually started out, he sent me a cool DM on Instagram when I moved into my new house. He had like a pumpkin avatar. His name is Jacques. I think he's like 80 years old. He's like, I think I'm your neighbor. And I'm like, oh my God, dude, I have like a stalker, you know? But it turns out he was like this young Bulgarian dude who was really into gardening. So he starts gardening in my backyard, just helping me out. He was one of the initial four team members that I mentioned. And I did not like the idea of hiring help and not showing that I have help, because it's not authentic to me to run like a huge garden and just be like, yeah, magically I'm doing it myself. So I go, hey, you know, Jacques here, he's been helping out a lot. And this is just on Instagram. And people just took a liking to him. He's a humble guy. He's a nice guy, a very good hearted guy. And they built affinity with him. And I said, hey, look, I want to make a YouTube channel for you, because I think your approach is different than my approach, and different approaches speaks right to the mission of our company, which is teach the world to grow. I can't speak to the world. I need more than me, right? And so, you know, that was a great way to do it. The beauty of having Jacques, and you know, Jacques's a full-time like salaried team member, is that he can do more than just create. He can research, he can prep, he can product test. When you get into like the pure talent, that's where it gets harder, I think, and it's where we've stumbled more. We tried to replicate the Jacques approach by hiring people that I thought were good at content. The problem is, and it depends on how you structure the deal, but like we didn't own the content that was being produced unless it went on our channels. But if it went on their social channels, it's not like we purchased their channel or anything like that, which we could have done, but we didn't. And it just created weird incentives of like, where do you post and why? And it was sort of like really expensive affiliate deals, frankly. So it just didn't really work out. Now what we're trying is on our main channel, which is Epic Gardening, I put a video out saying like, hey, look, Epic Gardening's changing. You're going to see more faces here, because I've done this for so long. Like there's a level of I can't do it at this capacity anymore, but there's also a level of like, you guys deserve better teachers on certain things. And so now we're running a model where we're testing people, much like I tested Jacques, but they don't live near me. So I have to test them like in public on these channels, just see what people think. And so we're helping them with production, with scripting, with cinematography and editing and all that. But they're the talent, like they're showing us how to grow the blueberries or showing us how to grow the raspberries. And then I'll be scouring the comments, just seeing how those videos are received. And then I will escalate or de-escalate based on that. And so that's the way I'm doing it now. And then I think you just pay like a contract per host type of arrangement, at least right now.
That's kind of the Barstool method. That's how they've done it. You kind of work in like a shorter time pieces, just read the comments, see the fan engagement, less of views, impressions. And I mean, I think they're a perfect example of
Clearly
like
that worked for them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's worked for them. Right. One of the through lines though, that I don't think is talked about enough with this. And if I had Erica ever on the podcast, which I've begged her to, but she's not here yet.
Yeah.
But one of the through lines that has to happen to make that work is there does have to be something that connects all of them in some way to the brand.
Yeah.
And I mean, it literally can be certain type of language, colors, bot, like something though. When you think about the talent and how you are building that network out, what's the through line?
So this is something that I've studied Barstool a lot and just to go back really quickly on their method, it's a Darwinian process. They're exposing these people to sort of natural selection, if you want to call it that, by the audience. And then they're weaning out back and forth. It's the only reliable way to find someone who performs, right? Because you can't judge it qualitatively yourself and then just go put it out there and just expect that everyone else will agree with you, right? So that they did a really good job at that. As far as like creating this connective tissue, I try to think of it as like an MCU. I call it the Epic Gardening Ecosystem. And we're actually working on some rebranding right now that it's closer to the vision I have of what we're trying to build. It's like, hey, you know, Kevin's here in San Diego. He's got his homestead that's all high tech and stuff. Jacques over there, it's a little bit more natural, a little bit more like homespun. We've got this woman, you know, Meg in North Carolina. She loves growing peanuts and sweet potatoes. And so we're trying to tie these people all together in the sort of digital ecosystem of our consumers' minds, right? So they go, oh yeah, like when Jacques and Meg talk, it feels like they know each other. They do, but it has to feel like that to the audience. And so there's some branding elements I think that we're working on that should help do that. But it's also like the interaction between the personalities on the respective channels. And so, you know, Jacques will come on mine and he'll troll me in the comments, or I'll troll him in the comments, or I'll pop on Meg's and we'll joke about something. And so then the audience is like, oh, this is a real thing. Like these yeah. people all know each other.
That network effect is like the sauce that is so obvious, but no one actually sometimes does.
Yeah.
It's like those comments and engagements across with each other.
I learned it from someone told me, who, but they're telling me about how ESPN works. And like, you know, anytime tennis is talked about on any show, whoever the tennis dude is will pop in, right? So there's a lead on a particular format or show who's running that, but they can call in whoever they want at any moment. So like a couple of weeks ago, Jacques texts me and he's like, yeah, you need to come over to my house real quick. I'm making like fermented Bulgarian sauerkraut and I want you to just like taste it really quickly. And so I just ran over, did a little 5-minute segment on his channel to show, right, that I'm still around in his world.
Yeah. At ESPN, it's like when they hired the guy that just like followed LeBron everywhere, like he was the LeBron guy. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's like you take the top topics and then assign that out. I think you guys are a really good case study of like seeing how to start doing that. And in a way that isn't, you know, Dear Media is coming on this season and we have Matthew Berry. There's like been different folks, but the uniqueness of what you guys are doing is that ultimately it's the drive product. And so some of these folks are great at getting attention and like knowing the social game, but like you have to really make sure you're driving product. I have had a whole theme of a podcast before called Content to Commerce. This is why I wanted you to have on the call. Like when you hear that, what do you think? What kind of comes to mind when people think Epic Gardening and Content to Commerce?
I mean, I think back in the day, honestly, I probably had a decent sized ego about it because, you know, before raising any capital and before scaling past about $10 million in revenue, I was like, I don't understand why anyone spend money on ads. This is just dumb. Like, you know, I'd release product for pre-sale. Obviously, there's a pandemic effect for some percentage of the time I'm talking about here, but you know, I'd release product for pre-sale and it'd be gone in, you know, a matter of minutes sometimes, a matter of a week sometimes. And so, you know, your cash, your free cash is quite favorable in those situations, and you're not spending money on ads, and you're sort of just like laughing at all these D2C brands who are spending like 30% of revenue on ads, and they're playing like that LTV and CAC equation, trying to like outscale everyone in an age of VC dollars being very cheap, or you know, whatever that was. And I just remember looking at that and thinking like, that's insane. Like, I just don't understand how that model works. And now, as we've added other acquisition channels, like we spend on media, we buy ads, and I realize there's a limit to the way that Content to Commerce can drive the business. It's almost like a rocket that the booster pack comes off, and then the rocket then goes on to Mars. It's the most efficient way to take you off Earth, but after that, you actually have to find and activate other channels.
Brilliant.
And so it runs out basically, and so like the creator or team of creators or content ecosystem, whatever format you're using in your business, is the best first channel. But if you over-rely on it, it starts to cause, I think, bad behavior within an organization. So, you know, I can speak to us, for example. If you pretend we had no organic content in our brand whatsoever, like most direct-to-consumer brands or even direct-to-consumer that has wholesale, you would go, Well, yeah, it's a little rough around the edges. You know, our customer support's absolutely amazing. Our NPS is 87, but that's because people love the brand. It's not necessarily because the product is getting there exactly when they expect it, right? Or, you know, so maybe our warehouse ops are a little slow that day or something like that. Like, I think content to commerce is an amazing starter, but it eventually becomes a crutch that has to save the business over and over again if the rest of the business isn't built up to like best in class levels.
The reason why that trap happens also, right, is this is just like prioritization, is if you do content first, the DNA of the business is content. Mm-hmm. If you do content second, you're probably not going to have good content because you're going to be making it for what you're trying to sell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the DNA of the business is content, right? And this is what's so complicated. It's what makes the like churning group, which has invested in you all, but you know what makes their portfolio so interesting is that they're almost all native DNA content businesses that all have some level of commerce to them, some at a super sophisticated level and some working their way there. And having two core competencies is really what I like to say, content and commerce, not content two, because content two makes it seem like you only need one of those. It's really, you have to have both, and particularly after a certain scale. So I think it's a super insightful point. And I think what most people honestly just overlook and screw up because they don't know what the other side of the hill looks like.
I told the team to think in reverse, commerce to content. Because if you think about like, so let's say we have a copycat competitor, right? There's like five of them out there, maybe more depending on the product line that we're offering. And they don't have the content. And so how are they getting customers? Well, they're just probably spending 5x what we might spend on paid. And so they're just acquiring customers via traditional sort of marketing methods. But then they drop into where? Just selling the products. They have nothing else. And so I go, if you don't know who we are, you might choose a competitor. If you know who we are, you never would. And so what we need to do is get better at figuring out how to get people to know who we are in a non-organic way, and then saying, oh, you just bought these amazing seeds or this raised bed or these seed trays. By the way, we literally have thousands of pieces of content on anything you could ever want. We're the biggest repository of content in the world in gardening. So have fun, you know, and then imagine the lock-in after that. So I think your point is great, like content and commerce, but you could think of it as content to commerce / commerce to content. And then it's a vascillating pendulum on whichever one you happen to be stronger on at the moment.
Let's look at like the most successful ads businesses right now. They all were commerce, Uber, Instacart, Amazon. And the reason for that, to your point, right, is like people liked what they initially offered. They had this attention and they kept coming back. And like that retail side is what you're essentially capturing and starting there first. And I think it's fun on the mass side, you're essentially flipping the whole LTV equation, where everyone, I think with content to commerce, and I think a lot of those TCG decks always talk about zero CAC, no CAC, right? Mm-hmm. You're kind of saying, hey, CAC's okay. We're going to just have way better LTV because of our content and the stickiness and the brand.
Yeah.
It's okay if we acquire these people for money because they're going to be around forever.
I'm personally a believer in like first order profitability on paid ad spend, especially in a consumer space like ours. Although, you know, we do offer seeds now, there are some recurring things that we offer, but regardless, like I think the baseline of being first order profitable is smart and wise. That being said, let's say, you know, you have a huge gap between your contribution profit is like really high. It might mean that you just should spend more up to some sort of tolerable dollar amount and kind of blow it out, because you're right. Like these sorts of businesses can over rely on, you know, Kevin getting on YouTube and launching a new product. And I try to tell the team, like, don't use me too much, because there's only so many pipes I can put content through. And I want the content to service the mission primarily. And so I can only sell like one out of five times, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very weird. It's very paradoxical, because the more you do it, the less it works. But if you don't do it, it doesn't work at all. You know, it's a very weird balance.
I mean, everything is a balance there, right? And I think order of operations also really matters, which is like a theme that I've been picking up in many of these conversations. Like content first is, if you're looking to do it, like that is like ultimately the right way. Mm-hmm. After that is like, just don't get too used to any channel that's successful, because like marketing has saturation issues no matter what. And that's just like part of the play. My last piece, I'd love to talk about this because I think it's bold as hell of what you guys have done. Like, you're taking on Better Home and Gardens. Mary, do you, you know, I mean, there's like so many massive amounts of capital resources of that corporation. And I think it's inspiring for anybody to say, I can take something out of my backyard with good production, good quality, and then go take on a generational multi-billion dollar business and kick their ass. And you guys are kind of doing that. How often do you assess how you're doing against that? If I'm starting something new, that there's a legacy player that's just dominated the aisles, how do you kind of mentally put yourself in that space to go do it?
Frankly, I don't think about it too often. The genesis of Epic even starting in the first place was me trying to learn about hydroponic gardening at the time and reading like university PDFs and like studies and stuff and trying to parse that as a non-gardener. I didn't grow up gardening. And so I was like, dude, this just doesn't make that much sense to me. Let me like try to synthesize this and translate it down into like a simple blog article. I mean, I think that's really what the sauce of what made Epic work is like, I'm not an expert. I don't proclaim to be. I just love doing it. I'll teach you how along with me. And then you translate that to all these different media formats. And when I, at least in the media side, when I look out at all these brands, I still go, they don't get it. Like, they don't understand the way that people want to consume. And these are like big companies, you know, they're publicly traded or something. I mean, maybe it's just they can't at their scale or whatever. But in that sense, I feel pretty confident. I mean, like, I think the results in that sense kind of speak for themselves. The harder part would be to scale products and take on some of those bigger players that then you're battling in the physical world. And that's a lot harder because then you have like to persuade a buyer to give you space and not the other vendor space who happens to have a 20-year relationship and like insane leverage against them or whatever. So that'll probably be a little harder. The way we've approached it now, I think is novel is when we purchased Botanical Interest, a seed company, we are distributed across about 4,200 stores, many of which are independents or small family chains. That's where the soul of the market is. If you have the soul and you service them to the best of your ability, well, who shops there? It's the passionate gardener, right? So if you really do that and you give the best service possible to that segment, then your leverage builds and then everyone else is going to be like, oh shit, like we kind of need to carry some Epic products now because literally everyone that walks in our store is asking for it. If you do that, then you just wait until you start, you know, seeing that happen. Well, then you go to those bigger players and you go, yeah, here are our terms. Like, if you don't want to, that's fine. We'll just keep selling in thousands of stores and you won't have this rep. You know what I mean? So that's the idea.
Yeah. I mean, you worked your way up with the leverage on each one and the brand plays into the fact. And like the other piece of that is like, I always say like vibe is real, right?
It's real.
And you know, people love having a new emerging brand in their mom and pop shop that is relatable and you're doing that. And I think that the takeaway of that also is that you're understanding your own customer journey. And I think you're talking about that, of course, from a product and commerce perspective, but like that matters from a content perspective too, right? Like you're walking yourself through that. You know where your passionate audience is, where they're living, where they're buying, where they're shopping. And that's helping you make these strategic decisions. And I think too often it's actually people get one way or the other. They just totally forget that like you're selling to humans that have real behaviors and patterns in life.
Mm-hmm.
Listening, taking care of that matters.
A lot of creators get stuck in that sort of middle ground. Like they'll have a couple of viral hits and they'll accrue a bit of a top line audience, but they're not getting the reach on that audience. And it's because they're creating, I call it like selfish content, right? Like I'm going to make what I want to make. And if it doesn't do well, I'm going to blame the algorithm or whatever. And that's the same in everything. It's like, what does the customer actually want? Like I told my team a couple of days ago, I was like, would you rather us be a company with a baller ass YouTube channel that everyone loves, but the products get there 50% slower than everyone else's, and we launch 50% worse products or something? Or the reverse, like we get there the day after you order it with products that last for a really long time and perform, but we don't have a YouTube channel. It's like, obviously the customer in the fullness of time chooses the latter option. And so it should only ever be seen as a bonus that we just happen to have this massive, passionate fan base that we're very grateful for. But we shouldn't do the disservice of disrespecting them by not executing at a high level in every other part of the business. So that's the piece it's very hard to do sometimes.
Yeah, it could feel like kind of like content's the whole ice cream cone. And really, it's like just the cone supporting it. And then the actually thing people care about is the commerce. But
yeah.
The last kind of question I ask a lot of folks is, you know, the industry, the reason why this podcast is called Perpetual is I think things are always changing in this industry. Yeah. You've been at this business 8 years, which you don't have that perspective a lot with founders that have been around that long. But I always ask about the next 5 years. There's a lot of shifts happening, trends, some that you're trying to take advantage of. What excites you the most that's evolving in over the next few years?
Five in content is such a crazy amount of time. It's honestly hard to say because five would be the whole reign of TikTok, right? I mean, to predict that entire thing. I do think on some platforms, we'll see sort of this, a bit of a return to like longer format, a little bit more drawn out, I call it passive consumption style content. In MySpace, actually, there's a lot of it. There are these creators who do 30-minute videos, more aesthetic, lots of music, a little bit of voiceover, very aspirational type thing. I think you'll see a little more of that. I have no idea what will happen as a result of like Vision Pro and what will go on there. I mean, no surprise as a gardener, like I'm not super stoked on that, but I have to play where people are. So if that happens, then I'll be there. I do think my general idea on this whole creator content to commerce world is that I think the time for it has passed to some degree in the sense of like it's established, everyone knows how to do it and what it is. And there's examples to point to, like you could point to us or you could point to Mr. Beast or Logan Paul. And so the consumer space, I think, is getting eaten alive already, like Emma Chamberlain, Chamberlain Coffee, like all the obvious categories have a player. And some of those players will win, some will not. I think a huge trend that I would be putting some money behind or trying to back, and sounds like, I mean, you're probably just doing this, is I just don't understand why there wouldn't be more B2B content to SaaS or content to software or something like that. Like, you know, there's that woman, Miss Excel on TikTok. She's done a great job, I think, at translating that into course sales, like 100K a month in course sales, which is it's a $1 million business. And if that's all she ever wants to be, she could sail off into the sunset on that. But that being said, like, I don't understand why some of these creators who are more B2B don't start aligning themselves with like software companies, taking small pieces of equity in their favorite brands or whatever. It seems smarter, but we'll have to see. It could be the case.
I like that trend.
Yeah, it's right up your alley, right?
That's what we do. So I like that. Well, I appreciate it. I think you are the definition of a trendsetter, but sometimes trends kind of like fade away and your revenue and growth of the company is like proven that you've created just a really sustainable, great business. And there's a lot for folks to take away. So appreciate you coming on today and spending time with us.
Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you want deep insight and hot takes on the world of media, make sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. I'll see you next time.